Hey, y'all. Welcome back to Group Therapy. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Kristen Casey.
I'm licensed psychologist, Dr. Jessica Rabin.
I'm licensed psychologist, Dr. Jay.
And I'm licensed clinical social worker, Kristen Gingrich, because I didn't want to do a dissertation.
I love it. Today, we're talking all about religious trauma and purity culture. I'm also super excited to announce that we have a fantastic guest joining us later, Emily Maynard, licensed marriage and family therapist, who will give us even more information on this topic. So settle in, take a seat, and welcome to group therapy. Woo! So does anybody have experience working with religious trauma or purity culture?
Not as a primary focus. I would say, if anything, working in the South with a lot of LGBTQ plus individuals, like, religious messaging may come up and trauma related to religion, but it's not why they are seeking therapy. And then with purity culture, since that was really a movement of the 90s, I don't work with people who were alive then to experience it.
Yeah. Also, spending some time in the South, that's where I got my degree. Like, the way, I guess we'll talk about defining purity culture and the different ways that comes out. There's been a lot of conversations about that and how that relates to how we form romantic or sexual relationships. But I've had a couple clients specifically come for treatment with religious trauma. Not an expertise of mine per se, but like, I've had the experience for sure.
Yeah, my experience is very similar to yours, Justin. I have a couple of clients that I've worked with, and it wasn't, I mean, in my experience, it wasn't the primary focus of our treatment. It happened to come up in therapy. And it's been great. You know, I've done some trainings on it, but definitely not an area that I'm fluent in. And I'm really excited to learn more in our discussion today.
So, Justin, I mean, you just kind of brought it up, like, with defining. So I would say we should probably start with defining either purity culture or religious trauma. Does anyone take a stab at either one, or... I can also go, but I feel like I define things a lot on this podcast.
But you're really good at
it. Because you have it. Because you have it up on the screen already.
Well, so when I think of purity culture, I really think of like the 1990s, the movement within Christianity, which really emphasized like sexual abstinence, like no sex before marriage, dating was discouraged. Purity rings, you know, vowing to stay virgin until marriage, very traditional gender roles, which I love that we're doing this episode right after we just did the taboo episode, because we were talking about like sex and kinks and things like that. And purity culture is literally the opposite of that.
Yeah, it's dead opposite. Although I agree with you, like the purity culture, like, sort of peaked maybe in the 90s. I think it's related to a lot of ongoing religions and, yeah, how you stay pure and that you should avoid sexual or maybe even romantic relationships until marriage. Again, having been in the Deep South and working with a lot of people where religion plays a huge part of their day-to-day lives, you know, when it resonates and it fits for you and this is the scope at which you live your lives, it's one thing. But for a lot of people, you know, they start collecting experiences in their lives. They start expanding, and a lot of the things they had gone through or said to them, they realize were forms of control. And some of them, of course, meet full criteria for trauma. And they were having traumatic experiences, not just one time, but over several instances of being shamed or ridiculed or, controlled comes to mind a lot.
I was thinking the same thing, because I think a lot of people who find themselves in therapy who've experienced something like this, a lot of times there is that process of like, how do I regain my sense of power? How do I regain my sense of self? I don't really know, you know, what I want in life. Maybe like we take an exploratory approach, because I think that a lot of obviously morals and values might be prescribed for people who find themselves in situations like that. Not everybody, but at least the clients that I've seen. And I always tend to wonder, like, you know, if you grew up in that type of culture, what that process looks like day to day as you're kind of deconstructing. I know a lot of people use that word too, when they're in therapy. I'm like deconstructing my thoughts around this, you know, and trying to live a life that's meaningful for me now. So I could tell that there's like a lot of mixed emotions for people going through something like this.
So, well, you, like you said, like you're deconstructing an entire belief system.
Yeah.
that you grew up your entire life believing. And whether coming to believe like it's not true, somewhere in the middle, whatever that is, like that is really difficult because the innate piece is always to fall back, right? We fall back into habit. We fall back into comfortability, even though we don't want that. That's something I hear often of people who are deconstructing is that they sometimes find themselves stepping back or leaning back into it and not even realizing that they're doing it.
That's a really good point too. Cause I think that when you're, like you said, you're trying to construct or deconstruct an entire belief system, there's probably a lot of feelings of inadequacy too. And like trying to figure this out because you don't have potentially, you know, if you're not still involved in that culture, you might not know who to turn to, you know, if you're going through something like that. I'm interested to hear Emily's take on it as well of like what the path is for people, you know, to start to think about these things differently. And I know we're talking a lot about purity culture. I think religious trauma is also something that we could define. Does anybody have any thoughts? I don't really know how to define it, to be honest with you.
I mean, I think it's hard to define because there's like not one definition of trauma when it comes to religious trauma. I mean, I usually think of it as like any type of spiritual abuse or negative messaging that you received within a religious context. So we think a lot about like messaging that really instills shame, guilt, using kind of like coercion, like putting the fear. You hear a lot of people talk about like they grew up in a religion that like they were to fear God. You know, if you would be condemned if you do, you know, X, Y, or Z. So those are the things I think about, but like how or what could be religious trauma for people, I feel like is so far and wide depending on the individual, the religion, if they work on deconstruction, if they, you know, have friends that are outside of their religion and see different worldviews.
I think to that end, because when we talk about trauma, you know, sometimes we talk about PTSD, sometimes we talk about CPTSD. There's something about it that feels different when you talk about religious trauma. Like I certainly, in my experiences in helping people with it and the narratives that have been shared to me, they certainly don't always look like PTSD. I think, and it's not to say that can't happen, of course, at any time, in any context, something can happen that feels like, you know, safety or life threatening in different ways that could happen anywhere in any context. So it could look that way. But I think more often it's in the form of exactly what you're naming of like sort of repetitive messages and events that damage the way we look at ourselves or how we carry ourselves or how we show up. And I think it is really hard in what KBI was alluding to of when you're living that day in and day out, especially as youth. It's so hard to be able to see outside of it, to see like, you know, the ways I get treated, the ways I'm allowed to think of myself in any way, not just a sexual being, but any type of being with some form of autonomy and have my own ideas and thoughts, that it just, yeah, it gets embedded in you. And that's why people who have gone through, you know, religious trauma, it sort of shows up like CPTSD, that there's a lot of doubting of the self. There's a lot of feeling like bad and having tough times showing up authentically in relationships. I've seen it impact the social aspect probably more than maybe kind of classic PTSD. Not to say that wouldn't, but but there's something more ingrained in it.
I love that you brought that up because like, exactly like you were saying, we think of PTSD, we think of like flashbacks and things like that. When I've seen religious trauma, I've seen it a lot in the form of like identity, like not knowing who a person is, maybe that decreased self-worth, like obviously depression, anxiety, a lot of, you know, sexual intimacy issues. I've also seen like difficulty making decisions. Like I have lived with this narrative and this belief system for so long. Like, what do I believe? Can I make this choice? Especially for women. And I've learned a lot just like following Emily and other accounts that really talk about religious trauma, but like learning who you are and being able to, like, we keep using the word deconstruct those beliefs that you were raised in, and realize it's okay to think differently, because so much of religious trauma, from my understanding, is that guilt, shame, like really like pushing you down so you don't think for yourself. And then your eyes are opened and you're like, holy crap. Like, what, how do I even go from here?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people experiencing religious trauma, they might be grieving to the opportunity to have options to critically think in a way that's autonomous or, you know, just for them. So I think a lot of times people might feel this sense of like, I've lost out on time that I've had in my youth or that I had early on to kind of figure this whole life thing out. And that's got to be hard. You know, that's got to be really, really hard for people. And I'd imagine it being like almost like a whirlwind trying to figure it out. And then to Jess's point, you made a really, really great point of like, people might actually feel like it's wrong to think for themselves because they're just not used to doing it. They're just not used to doing it. It's like a new skill that they're learning. So I think there's a lot of shame embedded in there as well.
I think shame is a huge thing, both in purity culture and religious trauma. And we could argue that purity culture is like a form of religious trauma for people that went through it and experienced it. But yeah, I mean, all of us have felt shame at some point about something. But if that was your life for 16, 18, 24, 40 years, and you're getting these messages that you're not good enough, or if you do X, Y, or Z, you're going to go to hell if you are in a religion that believes that being subservient, like all of those things, like, I can just imagine all of the negative mental health consequences that may come from experiencing religious trauma, whether that is depression, anxiety, eating issues, just feeling lost, lonely, isolated, because that's not something we've talked about yet, but a lot of these religious institutions that people have broken free from are very isolating. So people grow up and they're just around only other people that think like them.
Yeah, I think it goes into like what we know of like some of the best benefits of being involved in any religion are the social ones. But what if those social ones, exactly what you're alluding to, make you feel less than or make you feel shameful, make you not like yourself? Like, how, if this, you know, religious community is such a big part of your day-to-day life or the small town that you're in or whatever, how do you start understanding the impact it's having on you? Which is why I think, especially with religious trauma, you see people over the course of years putting things together, or not until they're sort of out of that. Maybe some of them go to, you know, undergrad somewhere else or like get a job somewhere else, and they have like the separation from it to start sort of understanding the impact. Because when you're embedded within it, these are the community you live in. These are your friends. This is also the people you go to their birth. Like, how do you start to feel and understand its impact? I think this is why it can take, you know, some people years and years to understand that.
Yeah, there's so many layers to it. So many layers to it. And I'm even, as you were talking, I was thinking of like all the people that would be in a situation like that and all the people alongside them that might not feel that same way about the religion, right? So I think it's right. Really important to highlight too that not all religion will cause this for everybody. You know, I think that for some people, they might be in certain, you know, religious denominations in certain states or certain cities or wherever they are that might have a tendency for these things. Who knows? But I have seen really great things as well for people in organized religion. It feels like they have a sense of, like you said, just in community, a sense of belonging. There's people, like-minded people that have similar values. But we do see it go south a lot of times too. So I think it's important to hold space for both.
Yeah, we certainly, maybe we should have put that caveat at the beginning of this episode. We certainly don't want listeners to think religion is bad. That's not what this episode is. But when religion turns into a traumatic experience for people, you know, what have they gone through? And sort of, yeah, we keep jumping back and forth of like, what has the impact been specifically of purity culture? on people thinking about romantic sexual relationships. That's why we're having this dialogue. And part of me wondered, like, we haven't shared anything about ourselves. Like, did any of you, I know a lot of us grew up in the 90s. Maybe KBI grew up in, you know, 2010. She's 24 years old over there.
But yeah. It's the usefulness that I just express.
I'm not going to say it. It's not true. It is. It's the exuberance. You're our local Swifty in the bunch, too. Mm-hmm. But did you get any of these messages? Like, were you part of a religious group? It's not to say air your trauma, but I'm curious.
No. No. I mean, it was talked about. It was talked about in a way of like we didn't talk about sex in my house. We didn't talk about any of, like, it was basically like, just be with someone that you love, but also, like, you can love someone in 2 days and that doesn't mean that they're, like, the right person. I specifically, like, grew up not believing in any higher power because of my trauma. And I remember going to church for a year out of spite. Mm. Because my family was like, there's no way you could believe that if you've never been to church. And I was like, watch me. And so I went to church for a year. I personally just did not. And it just was never, I didn't experience any of that. It actually more solidified for me in that opposite direction of like, yeah, I'm good over here. But no, I didn't really, I mean, I saw purity culture happen. Like, I saw the purity rings. I saw the holier than thou because I haven't had sex and you have. But I didn't personally experience, that, it mostly because it just wasn't talked about in my house. And that's a whole other of it when we don't talk about it, which is also a piece of pure, I could argue that is a piece of purity culture when you don't talk about it outside of, you know, the abstinence only, right. You know, I grew up with abstinence only health classes. They didn't talk about what safe sex was, or healthy sex or anything like that. It was just don't have it. So I would say that that's probably the extent of my purity culture experience.
I grew up Catholic. So I want to be like, enough said, but that's kind of curious. Yeah. Like, so I grew up in a very Irish Catholic family with majority of my family still practicing Catholicism. I don't anymore. So I definitely got messages of, you know, no sex before marriage, marriage is between a man and a woman, abortion is wrong, like all of these messages from a very religious lens. I don't personally feel like I have experienced religious trauma. I should have clarified. So I say I grew up Catholic, which I did. My dad's Catholic. My dad's family's Catholic. My mom's Presbyterian. They did not merge religions when they got married. So my sister and I actually grew up in both churches, two churches every Sunday, through high school. And I went to Catholic school and, all of that. So I definitely got a lot of, I got negative messages about mental health. And then I went to college, kind of broke away from religion, then went to a non-denominational church and have kind of just found my own spiritual beliefs and religious beliefs in all of that exploration. So I definitely received messaging. I definitely didn't do my own deconstruction until I was in college and wasn't like going to two churches every Sunday, and could think for myself. You know, I moved from New England, which is very heavily Catholic, to the South, which nobody here is Catholic, but we have Southern Baptist. And, so just being exposed to all different within, Christianity, primarily. I will say I was also exposed to a lot of Judaism and Islam growing up as well, just with my, like, where I lived. So yeah, definitely received messages, but I don't consider myself as someone that has had religious trauma per se, because I feel like I've been able to kind of think for myself, and I have parents that encourage me and my sister to think for ourselves. So yeah, that's my religious story.
Thanks for coming to my TED Talk. No, I love it. I love how you said I was raised Catholic. End of story. My grandparents were extremely religious. My grandma was like, oh my gosh, she was so mad at me for never going to church. She's like, oh my gosh, you got to believe in something, all this stuff. And I grew up Catholic up until like a certain point. My mom specifically was like, hey, if you ever want to get married in a church, like just do this whole thing, you know, confirmation, communion, that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I just never really went back because I just didn't really have any connection. And my parents didn't really, to be honest with you, I love them to death. They were like, just do whatever you want. And I'm like, at that age, I probably needed some guidance, but sure. So I was like, I don't want to go to church on Sundays because I want to hang out with my friends. So that's kind of how that happened. But no religious trauma here. I found spirituality later in life, probably not later in life, I guess later after that, around like 17, 18. And I've been practicing and following it ever since. And that's been really healing for me to be able to connect in that way. It's not something that I talk about that often, but I've actually had a really great experience, you know, with religion and spirituality. So I haven't had any like overall negative experiences just from personal experience, but I know a lot of people who have. So Justin, what about you?
Yeah, I appreciate y'all sharing that, because I think it's the elements that like we connect to or don't connect with, but at least understand the different frames of our narrative and others' experiences. And yeah, mine's very similar to yours, K-10. Like my grandparents are super Catholic, always wanted us to go to church. After I grew up in a matriarchal family, like my grandma ran the show. Whatever grandma said happened. And unfortunately, my grandma died when I was in sixth grade of a massive heart attack, like spontaneously. And then our family really like fell apart. Like we didn't meet for a Catholic church anymore. And my only experiences then going to church were like, oh, my friends are going on this religious, you know, trip to Philadelphia and I get to go to Philly for free. So I'm going to start going to the church for a month so I can go to Philly. And have a blast. KBI, yo.
KBI is like, I did that.
Oh, yeah. Youth group is having a cookout. Absolutely. Yeah. What's up, guys? Jesus.
Give me a plate. Let me.
But I literally, so it's funny because I have a scar on my foot from youth group being dragged across a carpet fighting over a Snickers bar.
That sounds like a lot to deconstruct.
That needs to happen.
But it got to a point where like it just started like you like it was social. All like my friends were all going, so we just all went. It was fun.
And that 100%, I overlap perfectly. And I can't tell you the amount of different churches, from Methodist to Lutheran to like I've attended some churches, but I think that's the thing is like. You know, I've been open to it my entire life. I remember the purity wave, like, and it impacted the hometown I grew up in. Mm-hmm. Any girl I dated was like, had the rings. Like, it was a huge thing in Little Wadsworth, Ohio, growing up in the 90s. So, like, I felt the implications of that and lack of any sort of sexual education, awareness, you know, recognizing us even as sexual beings at all. But yeah, I haven't had anything that's like traumatic. And I agree, like my own spiritual sense has grown like in adulthood of like what resonates with me and what makes sense to me and sort of incorporating science and these other things that for me just, yeah, resonate and sort of make sense. Where I think that's the beauty of any sort of faith-based things is there's a point where it's like, oh, you got to have faith and this either resonates with you or it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that journey is something that's always changing and growing. But for some people, they've just been a part of this community since, you know, they were born and mm-hmm. they've always been a part of it. Like they don't really have those sort of zoom out or collecting other cultural experiences.
Mm-hmm. And a thought I just had, Justin, as you were talking and reflecting on conversation we had earlier about exactly what you just said, growing up in, you know, that community, not really having outlets. And thinking about like the 90s and early 2000s, it wasn't just in these religious entities that we were getting these messages. Like, we were getting these messages from like pop stars. Cause if you think about it, how much obsession was there over like Britney Spears's virginity, Jessica Simpson's virginity, the Jonas Brothers, Miley Cyrus all had purity rings. So like, even if you weren't in a religion that emphasized these things, you're turning on the radio, the TV, and seeing celebrities talking about it. So that's going to influence young individuals as well, which to my knowledge, literally all of them have like gone back and been like, yeah, no, I like threw away my purity ring and things like that. But even like, I imagine it's hard for people that grew up in it to like get out of it. But even for people who didn't grow up in it, they're still receiving some of this messaging, and maybe we go seek out, oh, you know, which I don't know, it was just a thought that came to mind. And also like, why were we so obsessed with teenagers' virginity in the 90s and early 2000s?
It's wild. Yeah. Now that you say that, I'm like thinking back, and I do remember like when I did go to church one time, that I just remember the priest saying like, the marriage is between a man and a woman, and me, my bisexual ass, I was like, oh my God, really? Like, okay, I'm doing something wrong, you know? I'm young, and I'm like, I know I'm bi, like, I know I'm bi, you know, when you know, right? So I'm just like sitting there like, oh, I don't fit in here. But I was closeted at that point, so I didn't say anything. And it wasn't like a traumatic experience. I just knew that I might not be welcomed. And maybe that's the reason why I didn't go back, now that I'm like putting the pieces together right now. So I wonder if that impacts things, like the messages that you receive, like you're talking about, like they either resonate or maybe they don't. And then if you're stuck in that situation, like how do you make sense of your place in that? If your family is a part of it, the whole community, like Justin was saying, like that must be so hard. You know, that must be really difficult.
Well, K-10, I think you bring up a really good point that we haven't really touched on, like sexuality and things like that. And, you know, you said the thing about like, oh, I feel like I'm doing something wrong. And I think that's the crux of religious trauma, is that the messaging you receive, like some people might be like, oh, I'm not welcome here, not going back. But it's that internalization of like, oh, I must be doing something wrong, so let me try harder to like prove myself in this religion. And you're just kind of in that cycle of, you know, I don't know, suppressing your identity. And that goes back to something we talked about earlier, how when people finally like start deconstructing, they have this loss of identity because they're like, I've received these messages my whole life about this. And especially I think of sexual orientation a lot. And that's a lot of my worldview with religious trauma, sexual orientation, gender identity. It's like, I didn't fully allow myself to recognize who I was until I was in my 30s because of all the messages that I received.
There's always a message we like to receive. I don't know.
With the Google Scholar shorts.
The message.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do it.
We like science.
We love science.
So hard.
We fail at transitions. So one thing we haven't talked about a lot within religious trauma explicitly is sexual abuse. And we hear a lot about that, especially in Catholicism. And I feel like I can say that growing up Catholic. So honestly, the question I'm going to pose to you all is a very broad question. And I have way more research that's unrelated to this question, but that's the only way I could kind of connect it. So how do you think childhood sexual abuse compares in Anabaptist religion? So those are things like Amish and Mennonites, compared to other church denominations. KBI's eyes got real wide.
Well, the Amish are my jam. That's where I grew up.
Any thoughts?
Objective. I'm trying to think, like, I first of all, I have no clue. Like no idea, but my gut is like, it's either higher or like significantly low. I feel like it's like an outlier or something like that for Amish, maybe. Again, just going off the jump, no idea.
Justin has no idea. He's just,
I think you finally posed the question I've literally never thought about in my life.
I'm like, I hadn't either until I found this article.
Because I don't have a single solitary thought besides I want to know.
Yeah. Okay. So this 2023 study focused on child sexual abuse and Anabaptism. Mm-hmm. So that's an umbrella term for a group of religions that grew out of belief of an adult baptism. So unlike Catholicism, for example, where you get baptized as an infant. So although there are many denominations, most well-known are Amish, Mennonites. And so they looked at childhood sexual abuse within religion and across different religions. So 48% of participants surveyed indicated that they had experienced childhood sexual abuse. And there was no significant differences among those who were either born Anabaptist, so like born into the Amish or Mennonite faiths, joined later, so joined Anabaptist faiths later, or raised in a completely different church. So overall, it was about 50% across all denominations, which I don't know, for me, somewhat was surprising. Like there's no differences across. But then they looked further and broke down, you know, a bunch of differences, but I want to highlight a few. So participants born Anabaptist were significantly more likely to remain Anabaptist if they had not been abused compared to if they have been abused. So 55% versus 40%. Of those who left Anabaptist churches, more who left all churches, so 70% of people, had been abused than those who had joined another church that wasn't Anabaptist, suggesting that children in religious households who are abused are more likely to not only leave their church of origin, but also leave church communities as a whole. They also looked at if these individuals were taught that childhood sexual abuse was a sin or if it was illegal or a crime. And so participants who were not taught that childhood sexual abuse was a sin were more likely to be sexually abused than those who were taught it was a sin. And the same was true for the relationship between being taught childhood sexual abuse was a crime and being sexually abused. So participants who were not taught it was a crime were more likely to be sexually abused than those who were taught it was a crime. And then there were no significant differences between Anabaptist-born or not Anabaptist-born participants being taught that childhood sexual abuse was a sin based on their church of origin. However, there was a significant difference between those who were born Anabaptist and those who were not in the likelihood that they were taught childhood sexual abuse was a crime, with those being born Anabaptist more likely to report they have never been taught that childhood sexual abuse was a crime. So I know I threw a lot out there, but any thoughts?
The criminal part makes sense. It's just, you know, we think about the ways in a lot of different cultures, especially here in America, how things have changed. Maybe me having a toddler, it's right in my mind of like what you teach kids at a young age now about like bodily autonomy and what is good touch, bad touch, what is literally a crime. I don't think I use that language with my son, but it's like you already educate because of all the things that have gone on, you know, in the Catholic Church and other places. It's just interesting how as millennial parents, I think most of us are already trying to correct and at least inform, you know, that education early, because yeah, that never happened when I was growing up. No one told me about good touch, bad touch, or any of that stuff.
When I think it goes to kind of the theme that we had been talking about, like the messaging and whether it's intentional or not intentional, whether it goes back to purity culture and we just don't talk about it. But if people, exactly like you're saying, Justin, if people don't have the language to know, like this is, whether it's a sin or it's a crime, they're more likely to be victims. And this is not victim blaming by any means, but if we're not told it's wrong, they're not going to report it. And then the abuse just continues.
Yeah, the knowledge is super helpful, you know.
Know what else is super helpful?
That was good.
The data. The data from the polls. All right. Well, somewhere here I have it. Here they are right here. Thank you, as always, jumping in the polls. First thing I asked was, did you and your family follow any religious practices growing up? You know, I was just kind of curious. I'm just yes, no, or occasionally. What do you think our followers, did they have any religious practices growing up?
Occasionally?
I feel like yes, because I feel like most of our followers are millennials, right?
Maybe.
I don't know. I know we took that data one time.
Yes, 67% thought was yes.
Oh, wow.
18% occasionally, 15% no. Have you experienced what you consider religious trauma? Yes, no, or I'm not sure.
I feel like I'm not sure. It's higher.
I would agree with KBI.
This is one of the closest polls, at least I've ever seen. 38% said yes, 37% said no, and 25% said I'm not sure.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. I was a little surprised.
Yeah. Interesting.
Did you get messages from purity culture growing up? Yes, no, or I'm not sure.
Yes.
I feel like I'm not sure is going to be the highest on this.
68% said yes. 21% oh, wow. said no. 11% I'm not sure. It's so interesting because in things like this, this is why it's cool to do these polls. Yeah, you know, I was surprised. I was like, wow, like well, this is a lot higher than I would have anticipated. But that's why we have these topics and we ask you guys what you want us to talk about and all the different things, because this has impacted a lot of y'all who are tuning in.
Hey, everyone. We are so, so excited to have our guest with us. Emily Maynard is a licensed marriage and family therapist in California. She grew up in a high control religion and purity culture and now works with people healing from religious trauma. Emily is certified in EMDR therapy and loves swearing and Jeopardy. So Emily, thank you so, so much for coming on. As we were saying before you hopped on, we really need you to talk about this topic and your expertise. So we're so thankful that you're here.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited.
So before we get into our group member questions, we do have a couple questions to get to know you a little better. So the first question we'd like to ask all our guests is, what made you start posting on social media?
The need for attention. Is it okay to talk about astrology? I'm a Leo, so...
There it is.
Yeah, let's blame the sun. I think that's always a good way to start. No, I think for me, it's a way that feels like giving back and contributing to the knowledge of the general public. Obviously, there's a ton of people that have created amazing content that I think really helped me. Like my deconstruction and leaving of high control religion and purity culture started in 2009 on Twitter, where there were all these conversations happening about people changing their relationship to the faith that I grew up in and the faith that they grew up in. And so I always feel like my first master's degree was on Twitter, and then my second master's degree was more expensive, but probably a little more respected. So yeah, social media is just like a continuation of those conversations on Instagram now and TikTok.
I love it. I love it. And I know you listen to our podcast. So the second question I'm hoping you prepared for, are you team muffins or team donuts?
I have to be on team muffins, I yes. think.
What?
Like a muffin with a little crunchy sugar on top. Like I could get up in the morning for that.
I mean, yeah, that is good.
There's
though.
Not a lot I want to get up in the morning yeah. for, but a streusel muffin.
A donut is like all sweet. And I feel like a muffin has some variety. You know, you could have like a less sweet muffin with like the crunchy sugar on top. Yeah. Streusel.
Yeah.
Muffins.
I had high hopes you were team muffin.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there was some swaying behind the scenes. Like there's some influence and confounding variables. Like Jess, it just seems like you might have impacted this one. I don't know.
I will send Emily and Mai's emails and DMs and prove to you that there was no swaying.
Emily wasn't brought
Are you
out.
Accusing her of election interference already?
I don't
it's
know.
Like, that's a ways
how
away.
How much she Venmo'd you, but me and K10 will at least probably only be able to afford half that. So yeah. good choice.
Absolutely not Venmo because that's Venmo. Trackable. We know Jess. Yeah. Jess is going to do anything. It's coming secret wire from the Caymans.
Yeah, I'm not putting a muffin on Venmo. Clearly, that would be way too obvious. Okay, so now that we know a little bit about your love for attention and that you're Team Muffins, we're going to get into our group member questions. And like I said, we are so excited that you're here answering, sharing your expertise. We got so many amazing questions from our group members. So we will try to get through as many as we can. So to start off, Katie from Utah asked, how do you know if you have religious trauma?
Such a good question. And I hope you've covered this already. But when I say religious trauma, I'm talking about something that's not diagnosable in the DSM. So religious trauma is sort of the phrase that we've tended to use, developed through community conversations. And it's not something that's diagnosable. It's not, you know, you might have PTSD if you meet the criteria for those symptoms criteria, but we're not going to diagnose religious trauma, but you can certainly talk about religious trauma in therapy. So I think of religious trauma as certainly something that's like at the more severe end of religious harm. So the Religious Trauma Institute talks about sort of levels of like adverse religious experiences that you might have had, certainly religious harm. And then that might result in something that kind of has the same symptom profile as other incidents that cause significant trauma impacts on the brain and the body and your social emotional functioning. So religious trauma is like a catch-all term, but I think like you can have a lot of experiences that you might want to call religious trauma, or you might want to choose a different name for them. And I support people kind of choosing their own names around those things. That's just the easiest way to phrase it. How do you know if you have it? I mean, I tend to believe people. So if you tell me you have it, or if you think you might have it, there's probably some possibility that you're experiencing some sort of impacts from your religious upbringing or religious teachings that you're exposed to, and call it religious trauma if you want to.
I have to say, Emily, at least for me, I can't speak for the entire group. It was validating to hear your definition of religious trauma, because earlier when we were talking, we're like, what is religious trauma? And we're like, it could be so many different things. And that distinction of it's not a diagnosable mental health condition. You could have PTSD from it, or you could not. And
right.
Yeah. So I appreciate your explanation.
Yeah. Adverse religious experiences might contribute to a whole host of other diagnoses, the same way like any other sort of cultural or life factor might show up as a particular formation or understanding of a diagnosis. But I think it's really helpful to notice, like, you get to have any kinds of experience you want. But if you're calling it religious trauma, it's probably something that relates to your experience of being in a religious community, being exposed to certain religious beliefs or practices, and then the ideas of those and how those have stayed with you in a way that's unhelpful or even really harmful.
Mm-hmm. Love it. So we actually got a lot of similar questions about this next broad topic. So for example, Amber from Maine asked a question. So did Em. So Amber asked, how do you deal with religious trauma when you still want a relationship with God? Similarly, Em said, how can we develop our personal faith when we've been hurt by religion, spirituality in the past? And we got a number of other questions similar on that vein. So what are your thoughts, Emily?
Yeah, I mean, I think the shortest answer is like, you can just do it. Like, you can have any sort of form of religious practice or belief that you want to hold. And if that's something that you're still interested in after religious harm, like, you are allowed to figure out how to do that. My experience growing up in evangelical and fundamentalist kind of high control Christianity meant that I had to do a lot of disentangling of like, what was I taught about the world and myself and the divine spirit and like other people? And I had to figure out, like, what of those things do I want to keep? What am I grateful for? Like, I have a deep understanding of love, of justice, like that compels me. But a lot of things, and I think I got those from my religious upbringing, but I think that there was a lot of things I wanted to leave behind. The purity culture, the ideas of like in-group and out-group, the ideas that like some people could be better than other people, just like fundamentally, that doesn't sit well with me anymore. So I think it can take a lot of time to explore and figure out, like, what do you want to believe now? What kind of religious practices are helpful? Like, sometimes I feel like belief might be too big of a word. Like, it's really abstract to figure out, like, what do you believe about the universe? And it's easier to decide, like, what do I want to do right now? Is there a cause that I want to support? Is there a way that I feel like I want to grow? Is there something I can do to give or serve or have compassion? It's a lot easier to figure out, like, which religious practices do you want to keep? Sometimes, even if like the beliefs are tripping you up or maybe feel a little bit confusing. Does that make sense with like,
oh yeah,
what you all experienced too? Like that, because I know some of you live in places where like there is a dominant religion. Like most people where you live are like one religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked a little bit before you hopped on about like our own experiences growing up in religion, and especially myself, Justin, and K-10 talked about like what we grew up in and then like how we kind of did our own deconstruction and figuring out like what our faith base is. But I love that you said like figure out the parts like that you liked about it, whether it's tradition, but maybe not the same values, or is there a cause you like? And I even love how you said, Emily, some of your values came from your religion, even if it's in a different form now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And anytime you're like trying to pursue something, but you've been hurt by something similar, it's really helpful to determine like, or distinguish like, what are the parts that hurt? Like, what are the messages you know you don't want to bring forward into your next expression of spirituality or your next practices? And that can help narrow down like maybe where you fit if you're looking to join a religious community again. Like, I know I need a place that like celebrates these values or welcomes these kinds of people. That can be like, it can eliminate a lot of religious practices maybe, but it's helpful to narrow down like a little bit of like, well, where do you fit now if you want a different faith than what you grew up with or what you used to be a part of? And how can you find people who maybe want to have a similar expression of their values or what's good or helpful in the world?
I just appreciate the nuance that you're laying out there, because I think a lot of us who have been through any form of trauma, it could feel all or nothing in the beginning of like, I want nothing to do with any of that shit. Like, you know, but then it, after time and space goes on, you can get into the nuance that you're describing of like, wait a second, there can be things that really resonated with me and that I really cherish. And there can be other things that I'm like, I totally want nothing to do with that, like going forward. But being able to disentangle it, like you said, is something that like time, space, maybe even a healing environment like therapy, people kind of need sometimes.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of good that religious practice can bring to certain people when it's something they choose rather than something that's like imposed on them or doesn't feel authentic to them. Like, I think there are wonderful people who practice religion and I'm very happy to like be in community with them and, you know, live in society with them. But the difference is like, how do you tell what's really harmful and how do you know how to like escape those situations? And then how do you, once you've healed enough, like choose what moving forward looks like? But it really can look like anything. I mean, I work with people who want to keep some element of faith practice, or maybe they want to practice a very different like formal religion than they were exposed to early on in their life. And I work with plenty of people who are like fine without it, or yeah, are even just like, you know, mad about it still. I'm like, yeah, that's totally legitimate way to feel. I don't know anybody who's like mad about religion who isn't valid in what they hated about that experience or how it harmed them.
So I know, Emily, just from knowing you and your content, you have a lot of experience with purity culture and shame. So we got a number of questions around that. So Taylor from Massachusetts asks, how do you break free from the shame that religious trauma has caused regarding my sexuality?
Ooh, well, I tend to think one of the best things that shatters shame is like talking to other people and building community, because I promise you, you are not alone in those feelings. Purity culture is pervasive in the United States. I think it's like largely powered by evangelical and white Christian religious movements. But it's something that like our secular culture has a really hard problem with too, right? Like we live in a very sex negative culture. So one of the first things that you can do is like assume you don't have accurate or updated sex education. And just like getting a lot of information about like, oh, I didn't know these things are possible, or my ideas of what sex or sexuality even is were very limited in some way. Like that's one of the greatest things too, is like get more information, expand your ideas of what's possible for you and for other people and your relationships, and then find other people who are also trying to break these shame patterns, who are trying to live authentically and like really purposeful, meaningful lives that include sex in some way. Like even if you're asexual, that is a legitimate sexual identity that you get to like think about and live out in a way that's authentic to you.
I love that. And so going on another question about purity culture, Michaela from California asked a really interesting question. After enduring an upbringing that forced purity culture, how do you recommend healing that doesn't swing to the other side of the spectrum? And swing to the other side was in quotes. So I guess we'll interpret what Michaela was meaning by that.
Yeah, I was so curious about what swing to the other side meant. The way that I've heard it most often in these conversations is like the idea that purity culture or enforced abstinence is somehow an opposite to promiscuity or having like a lot of sexual partners or sexual experiences. And I don't really think sex or sexuality works like that. I think what's opposite of purity culture is like a very purposeful, intentional, creative, authentic understanding of yourself and what sexual practices are good for you at this point in your life. What you're interested in, what you've tried, what you are maybe interested in more of, and what you're interested in like taking a break from or are doing less often. So I think first, like understanding, we're not talking about like a forced sexual exploration when we're talking about like stepping away from purity culture. We're talking about like space to even understand your own body, get more education, and figure out like, what are you interested in right now? I love the metaphor of like not thinking about sexuality as this like, or sexual experience as like a journey towards maybe like intercourse or orgasm or some of the like traditionally hyped up aspects of sexual exploration or experiences, but thinking about sex like a pizza, like what toppings do you want on it right now? Like, what do you want to include? What do you want to try next time? Maybe we could think of sex as like, you know, a box of donuts, and there might be a variety in there that you're like really into right now, something you used to like growing up. And something that you, I don't know, feel like you kind of want to try, but you're not sure about the coconut. So there's just like so much more space. There's so much more like space to think about what you want out of sexual experiences with yourself or with other people than this idea of purity culture, which says like, only abstinence until marriage, and the marriage has to be like heterosexual, and it has to last forever, and it has to be monogamous, and it has to be like this very specific, really limited way of being a human. But if you decide like, hey, I don't want to do certain sexual acts with certain people at this point in my life, like that's totally legitimate. And I support that. I think the more you can really connect with like what is authentic to you, the more satisfied you're going to be in your sex life and your personal life and your relationships.
You just like blew my mind in so many different ways, first of all. So thanks for like, just thanks for being here to like educate us. But I'm even thinking about like how with purity culture, and I'm a novice, no expert by any means here. I keep thinking about what you just said about the rigidity. And in my mind, I would think the opposite of that would be more rigidity, but just on the opposite end of the spectrum. And what you're saying too is that there's a lot of nuance and there's actually a lot of flexibility and exploration. That's what's on the other side of it. And I never really thought about it quite in that way. And what a beautiful way to think about sexuality, because that's what we work on with clients all the time, with sexuality is exploring. And I love your idea about the pizza toppings. I might steal that from you and quote you, of course, but
Yeah, that's not original to me. That's like a sex education thing I picked up along the way.
I love it. I love it. But thanks. Thanks for that. I really don't have any other comments. I just want to say thanks.
Yeah, I guess it was so amazing for me, like growing up in really intense purity culture. Like I'm talking about, like we didn't even have dating in my Christian community that I grew up in. We did something called courtship, where like parents would choose to pair together, obviously a like teenage boy and a teenage girl. And they had to have this like incredibly formal courtship to, in theory, like maintain purity while there was like chaperones. I went to multiple weddings. I was in weddings where people put the first kiss that they ever had, like in the program of their wedding. Super weird. And like super upsetting when you think about it now. But, I think like it's just really helpful to remember that it actually is none of your business what other people do in their private lives. And when you're thinking about what you want to do in your own life, like it's also, it doesn't really matter. Like there's no cosmic ideal of like practicing sexuality other than consent and pleasure and everybody having a good time and like probably cleaning up appropriately after. Like hygiene and health are probably helpful in that sense too.
Yeah, I love everything you said, other than you chose a box of donuts over a muffin variety after you said your team muffin.
I mean, I just wanted...
I was trying to play both sides. I was really trying to speak to the audience.
I wasn't going
to
bring it up, and then I was going to be like, what about butter in the muffins? But whatever.
But you know what doesn't exist? A variety or a variety box of muffins. Have you ever seen that?
That is...
It doesn't exist because no one likes muffins that much.
Stop it. Muffins have a place, but...
I do.
But can you butter a donut?
You don't need to.
Can butter anything, can't you?
It's fair.
You could.
Technically.
It doesn't sound good. Buttering a donut doesn't sound good. Buttering a muffin,
can I try it?
No.
Well, anyways, off of muffins and donuts. Isabella from Canada says, my dad's side of the family was incredibly religious and often forced me to talk about getting my communion and confirmation and wouldn't stop. And it was often frustrating because they didn't care about who I was and what I wanted. How should I approach them and telling them without getting too confrontational? And we got a lot of questions about like just communicating with religious family and things like that.
Yeah, this is something that I work with so many people around, and that's something that applies to my own life. And I try to put out content around it too, because I think that's the big question. Like, if you decide that your family is stable enough and like relational enough and functional enough to stay in contact with them, like, then what do you do? Certainly people might have to decide like to go no contact. That's obviously a legitimate way to handle a shift in faith from your parents or the community you grew up in. But it's really hard and it's going to be uncomfortable and you're probably going to feel misunderstood or like you have to keep your mouth shut a lot. And just know that that doesn't mean you're doing something wrong. You are interacting with people who have a really different set of beliefs and values driving their life than you do. And they're probably not going to be the people who will validate like whatever faith or values you still practice, because they're like so obsessed about the ones that they practice and whether or not you are aligned with them. So just don't know that like grief and anger and feeling like you have to just like be fake around these people are normal feelings. It doesn't mean you're doing anything wrong. It's just the way that it is. But I find there's a lot of value in like changing the subject. And I mean this like literally if I go to a group or if I'm going to be around a bunch of extended family, and I know there's certain conversations like I just don't want to be a part of. They're not good for me. I don't care about them. I practice standing up and leaving the conversation. I'm like, I have to go drink of water. I need to go use the restroom. I'm going to go pet a dog. I'm going to go talk to a baby. Like, I'm just going to regularly pick up my body and remember internally that like, I can just go be in another place. I don't have to be in any conversation I don't want to be in. And I can be extremely polite about it. Right? Like they can't get mad at you if you just having to have to keep going and getting drinks of water and then using the bathroom because you know, those work in tandem. Just drink a lot of water, a lot of potty breaks, walks outside, and really like maybe limit your time around those people. Yeah, I think that's like my tactic for any time I'm around conversations that I don't want to be a part of, is like, all I have to do is stay out of the freeze state that says like, I'm stuck in this conversation or people are going to be offended if I say no thanks. I've certainly practiced phrases in the mirror before I went somewhere where I just get really good at saying like, oh, I'm not interested in talking about that, or I don't have anything to add, or not sure what to say about that. And then practicing like just sitting in silence. And if they want to keep talking about it, my next move is to just say, excuse me, I have to go get a drink of water. Because you can't change other people, right? Like that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to change you and make you believe something you don't. But that's going to go both ways. Like you can't change them. I can't make anybody leave fundamentalism. And that's not my job anymore. Like I no longer have to convert people in or out of any belief system. I just have to live in my own ethics of like kindness and justice and love and keep getting out of the way.
I feel like you and KBI handle family functions very similarly.
Emily seems so polite, though. I'd be like,
okay, minus the politeness factor.
Fuck this. Bye. My favorite is, though.
Like, I mean, I think we have different families, too. Like, that. I have a family that I actually, like, enjoy, and we can maintain functionality, like, 80% of the time. Sorry, was that not real?
I love it so much. So accurate, no, though. That is, it's, that's not, that's very true in that piece of like that, you know, but it's also like, well, like you said, like one of the things you said is like, one of my favorite things is to say is, that's such a strange thing to say out loud. And then they're like, and they stare at you and you're just like, yeah, I don't get it. And then just walk away. My favorite.
Yeah, because so much of like the internal turmoil of like being around dysfunctional people is like having to try to like smooth everything over. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something I learned growing up in like a very dysfunctional religion, is like I knew how to anticipate everybody's needs and how to like smooth things over and make sure like so-and-so could get along with so-and-so because they had slightly different beliefs about this one minuscule little thing. And like, I'm just don't doing that. I'm just don't do that anymore.
No, not worth my time.
Yeah, not worth my time. But there is like, I don't know, just like a reality of the fact that everybody's got to deal with whatever your family's thing is. Like you have to deal with that. If your family is avoidant, congratulations, you're probably never going to have to explain your beliefs to them. Because if they start asking, you can just, again, like all you have to do is avoid that conversation for just a few minutes. And if your family is really chaotic and there's always like something new going on, like, I don't know, drop a bomb and run, like point out somebody else's flaw and get out of there and see what happens.
I just love that idea.
Also, never stay with your family. Oh my gosh. Never stay with your family. Decide what time you're leaving the function.
No functions ever happen at my house. Have someone on duty who can
call you.
Never happens at my house. Absolutely not.
No, never happens at your house.
Yeah, drive yourself there. Make sure you have cell connection to call that Uber. Yeah. No, this is...
An Irish goodbye is a great goodbye. You just leave.
So you just gave a lot of good tips about family. Mags from Atlanta, Georgia asked a question about friends. So she says, I have so much anger and resentment towards my old friends who are still in the radical cult-like church we grew up in. I hate feeling this way and miss them, but my emotions are taking over me. How can I begin to resolve this without pushing boundaries?
Ooh, there's so much in there about friendship, because I think one thing that high control religion really does is like it formalizes and helps you establish relationships really quickly. So whether that's like if you move, you just have to start going to like the new church in that religious group, like in your new area. People will welcome you. They'll jump in. They'll start like inviting you to their functions. They'll start like, I don't know, they'll just be all in. Or whether that looks like a deconstruction or religious trauma group where people just like show up, dump all their trauma and like expect an instant connection through that. Like know that it takes a while for like normal, healthy friendships to form. So your friendships after you leave a religious group, like you might be longing for your old friendships because you feel like we're so connected. Like we had all this stuff in common. But what's important to realize is like what you had in common was that religion. Like it was about that church. It wasn't really about authentic relationships between you and that other person because everyone is always performing to the standards of the group and nobody really gets to like talk about what's hard or challenging in life because you're always like on duty for the service of like this belief system. So just know that like you might miss your friends for a while and it might feel really strange to form new friendships. You might be a little bit like hypervigilant towards other people not liking you or maybe cutting you off. So this is the kind of thing where I think it is really helpful to be in therapy or be connected to some sort of support group. Because forming new relationships after like a relational trauma is really challenging. It hurts to be ostracized. Like it's so weird to know that there's all these other people who like used to need you and love you and they're just like existing without you. Like they just erased you. That is so fundamentally terrifying. But I think it is possible to start building new, healthier relationships after that. You just might need some extra help and support. And as far as anger, like be angry. Like don't act out of anger. Like don't use your words or actions to hurt somebody, but like get really mad. I think anger is such a powerful, clarifying emotion. And I always feel like, especially working with women, like when women can get angry and start expressing anger in a like normal, healthy way, I know they're going to be okay. Because they just connected to this like powerful force that women growing up in high control religion or even purity culture, like we're not allowed to have anger. We're supposed to like always be sweet and respectful and gentle and submissive and all these things that like actually cut us off from values and like a really activating, like forward moving system in our bodies. So get mad. Don't forgive them. Like, write a mean letter to them. Certainly unfollow them from social media because there's nothing more activating of relational trauma than like picking up the thing that's probably next to your bed and is probably the last thing you see before you go to sleep and the first thing you see in the morning. And knowing that at any time, images of like all those people who erased you, like living their normal lives without you, like don't let those be on your phone. Like, mute people if you have to, if you can't block them yet, but like protect a little bit of the space that's like right in front of your face. Cause you wouldn't let people like come up to you in your face and like tell you how much you sucked. And so don't let them do that by like putting their images in your social media feed in your face every morning.
KB is the queen of blocking people.
If you make me question anything about myself and more, and I always say like, there's a balance in that of like, you're making me question like, oh, am I in the wrong for like saying something wrong than I really did? But like, if you make me question my worth as a human, like block, there's not even a question. Like, nope, done. Oh, I just didn't block. Unfollow.
Yeah. Especially on social media. Like, yeah. That's there's no reason to have that in your face.
Like,
so Jean or Jeanne, sorry, I don't know how you pronounce your name, J-E-A-N-N-E, from Pennsylvania, asked two good questions, but really around this theme of like feeling behind in life because of religious upbringing. So she asked, how do you start dating as an adult and how do you begin to sort through the confusion after recognizing the harm of purity culture when it felt normal and right when it was surrounding you?
There's so much good stuff in there. I think especially like the first idea that stands out is that idea that like it can feel really safe and protective to have a very strong system telling you exactly what to do, telling other people what to do, and knowing like you are in the right. It just clears out all of those questions of like having to develop your own perspectives or an ethical position or learning about what you like or don't like if somebody's handing that to you and you just get to follow it. So know that it might be a little bit disorienting. And I love, like, there's so many books and resources out there now. Like, I love the book #Church2 by Emily Joy Allison. There's a new book called When Religion Hurts You by Dr. Laura E. Anderson or Laura A. Anderson. There's a new book out there called When Religion Hurts You by Dr. Laura Anderson that covers purity culture. And I think that's really helpful to start getting some like actual information about how do you physically and emotionally unwind the harm of what you experienced. And then like, how do you start dating? I mean, I think this was something that I had to figure out in my 20s after I grew up in like weird religious cult that was like, we don't date, didn't kiss anyone until I was 21. It is okay to be on your own timeline. Like wherever you are, your only job is to be there. Know that people have all kinds of different sexual and emotional and relational experiences. Some of them good, some of them bad. You know, when you have them as an adult doesn't make you better than anybody else, right? Like if you have a long delay or feel like you go through times where you're not in a relationship, your next relationship is not worse because you took that time. It's actually really helpful. And like, it's really nice to date people who know themselves, who are open to other people, who are like happy and satisfied in their own lives and seeking to like get to know other people. So the more you can cultivate those skills, the better your dating experiences are going to be. And I think it's going to be more helpful than even if you were like, I've done a ton of dating or I've been in a lot of relationships. Like not all those relationships or dating experiences were like happy and fulfilling and meaningful. So you have to deconstruct this idea that like more experience actually means better outcomes. I worked really hard on dating in my 20s because I was like a way that I was determined to crush the system that said like I couldn't trust myself and that there was something wrong with me for like wanting to go out with people. And it was really helpful because I learned that like I could have a lot of different conversations with a lot of different kind of people that I would have never met in other contexts. I learned new activities that were fun that I probably wouldn't have gone to if it wasn't for somebody being like, hey, do you want to go to an improv show? It's Tuesday night. And just like saying yes to those experiences. I was like way more connected to my community because I knew just like what was going on and like what kind of places were around. And then I learned like I could leave experiences that I wasn't having fun at. Like I think some of the most empowering dating experiences I had was when I was like, this is not fun. This person is not asking me any questions. I'm just going to say, you know what? Thank you so much. I think I'm going to leave now. I hope you have a great night. And like, that was so empowering to me that I was like, that was a successful dating experience. Not because I like met somebody that I wanted to be with forever, but because I like learned I could just stand up for myself. I could be polite and I could get out of situations I did not want to be in anymore. So expand your idea of dating, expand your idea of like, what you're doing. Know that nobody knows what they're doing, especially with dating. Like it's all so messy. You just got to go in there and start like trying things. Know that people are not nearly as judgmental as you think. And you also don't have to like go in and justify your lack of experience. I definitely did start dates with like, hey, I grew up in a cult. Like, you know, that was entertaining. But it wasn't necessarily like super successful again, other than like me just learning that I could just say random stuff and move on with my life. But no, like there was a lot of people I dated who didn't know I like didn't kiss anyone until I was 21 and didn't have any experience in previous relationships and was like trying to figure this all out for the first time at 25 instead of like 16.
I feel like once again, you and KBI have similar approaches. Like I could totally see her going on a first date and maybe not saying like she grew up in a cult, but being like, so my mom just like laying again, it out there.
Not wrong. Let's just get it out on the table. Let's just put it out there. It's fine.
It's a story for them. It's a story for you.
It's entertaining. It's
stand-up practice.
They need to know that I'm funny. That I am a comedian and they learn real quick. Now, they may not get the humor and I might get the deer in the headlights, but then I know that they're not for me. I'm just here for hee hee ha ha. And if I get the, then it's not what I'm looking for.
In all seriousness though, Emily, I love how you said expand your concept of dating. Cause I think that is so important because if you're going into at any age, but especially if you feel like you're behind, like if your concept of dating is I need to meet the one. I need to have this like perfect date. You're going to be disappointed because like, I'm sure anybody that has dated more than one person has been on bad dates before. And that's okay. And I love the example you gave and reframed like, you know, it was a successful date because I realized I was not having a good time and stood up for myself and left. Like, that's successful. So I appreciate you sharing that in the reframe.
Yeah. Purity culture and like high control religion says like there's one person for you and you're supposed to be with them forever. And that's fortunately not how life is. And life is actually a lot more expansive and interesting than that. There are plenty of people that I knew who, you know, got married at like 19 and now they're no longer married, but they're like happier. Mm-hmm. Right. So even the people who followed all the rules of those systems or like got the weird, creepy rewards of those systems, like that doesn't mean they have a good life. And your goal is not to like follow the rules. It's to figure out like, how do you have a good life with whatever you have access to right now? So dating being something that's not about finding the one, but that's about like learning to meet other people or learning how to be yourself in a lot of different conversations or learning to try new stuff or like hearing other people's stories. Like there's plenty of people that you'll meet in those experiences that are like interesting, valuable people, even if you don't connect with them on a romantic level. Mm-hmm. Like there's just a lot of wonderful interactions out there and very few of them are like, I'm going to marry this person.
Absolutely. So we have time for one more question, but there's like two I want to ask on the same vein. So I'm going to put them together because obviously we are all mental health professionals on here. And one thing we haven't really addressed is like addressing purity culture and religious trauma in therapy. So I'm going to ask both questions, but allow you to group your answer into one. So Roxy from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania says, besides sex therapy to undo the harms of purity culture and the churches that have preached it for too long, what other therapies can be used to help those recovering from purity culture? And then Nicole from Colorado, put four O's. That was not me, just like weirdly saying that. Said regarding religious trauma, is this more of like a niche area of expertise? And does the process in therapy look any different than healing from regular trauma? So wanted to get your insights and expertise on those types of things.
Yeah, you can all probably speak to like how it might show up in therapy or what might be helpful. But I think there's a lot of different therapies that are really effective for these kinds of issues, whether that's existential or gestalt or like CBT. My training is in narrative therapy and EMDR therapy. And so I think both of those work really well, but they work really well for me as a therapist. And so they don't work like no therapy modality works for every client or every issue. So part of it is figuring out like, do you want a very cognitive deconstruction where you get to like think about the thoughts, behaviors, and experiences about purity culture or religious trauma or how those things have impacted you? Like, are you looking for something that's more cognitive? Are you looking for something that's more somatic? Like, they will all be parts of the puzzle of healing. It's just figuring out like, what do you have access to right now? I think it is helpful to like prompt a therapist, especially a trauma therapist, and say like, these are some of my issues, or, you know, this has happened in my past. Are you a religious therapist or do you bring religion into your therapy work? Because there are a lot of people who might not disclose that on their website. Like, I wish they all did, but there's maybe people, depending on where you live, who might think it's just incredibly common to bring religious practices or prayers or ideas or recommendations into therapy. So if you can be upfront that like, hey, I have religious trauma in my background, or like I have a hard time with religion, like I don't want that to broaden to my therapy, and make sure that you get buy-in on that. Otherwise, I think some therapists can cause more harm. But there's a lot of different things that are effective, and there's a lot of different like things that you can do inside and outside of therapy to help heal some of these issues.
I love it.
Well, Emily, thank you so much for joining us today. Like, I learned a lot. I know that probably everybody else did. And this is just a conversation that just keeps coming up time and time again, especially on social media, as we kind of take these steps to really undo a lot of damage for a lot of people. So thank you again for coming. As always, everybody, make sure to rate, subscribe, and review the episode. Share it to a friend. Share it to your youth group buddy from when you were in high school. They might need it too. Never know. But we will see you next week in group therapy. Bye.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.
Bye.
Peace be with you.